Good evening, everybody. My name is Jack. Welcome back to Talk Openly. I'm here with my super excellent and wonderful and joyful friend, Daniel.
Hello, Jack. How are you? Good to see
I'm
you.
doing good to see you too. I'm kind of mixed up in my brain right now. I think I'm feeling a little bit like I have a mixture of like just wild excitement for no reason in particular. But also just yeah, kind of a weird day of just sitting and doing a training all day. So I'm a little bit like, now I'm ready to
Oh, bring
go.
that energy. We could use it.
You can
This
use
is
it.
great.
Yeah,
Yeah.
great.
We'll channel it into this discussion about ethical discipline.
Yeah, yes, which yes. It's somewhat has to do with restraining the sense doors and excitement, right? So something that will be good for me tonight.
Yeah, you got this. We'll see how it turns out.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, tell me what's going on. What's your week been like?
Oh my gosh. Fascinating, actually. So I had Darshan with Lama on Friday, and what was really interesting about that was that so before I went into Darshan, I had multiple days of this sort of like it was like an energy state that was palpable, and like not just by myself, not just by me, but by others as well, where I was sort of on edge and like not in at like a super happy place, right? Like I had some like tension or something, and it felt like pretty pronounced, right? And it was interesting because I brought it all in, and dumped it at the feet of Lama.
Yeah.
And what was really cool about it was, so we had, of course, like a really good discussion. He gave me just some very excellent teachings. And what was really cool about it was that when I left, I was like, wow, I feel different. Like I feel quite different. But then, like, I didn't think too much of it. I walked in the door to where I'm living, and my girlfriend looks at me, and she just like her eyes got kind of big, and she's like, "You look different." And she had
Oh.
seen me just an hour before, so it wasn't like a whatever. It wasn't because I dressed up or anything. And she was
Yeah.
like, "Wow, you like," she's like, "Really, like you look different. Like, how'd it go?" And I was like, "It was really good. Like, we had a really good session." And she was like, "I could tell whatever happened, like I could just tell already, like the whole your whole there's been a huge shift in your like the way that you like look and feel."
Yeah.
And I thought that was kind of cool, right? Because on my own end, I was like, yeah, I feel different. I feel, that was like almost like a load being lifted, or like a dirty windshield being washed clean or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I had that sort of sense myself, but what I thought was really neat was that somebody else could tell right away,
Yeah.
without even, I didn't even say a word. Like it was
You
interesting.
just walked in the door, a
Just
different
walked in the
person. Yeah.
door,
Yeah.
and it's interesting because it's not, it wasn't, I don't think anyway that it was anything in particular that he said. There was just something in that meeting, that face-to-face meeting that happened. I
Yeah.
don't know what it was. I could come up with all kinds of ideas about what might have been going on there, but it just sort of for me really brought home the importance of having a good teacher, a spiritual friend who sees us and is willing to to speak directly to where we are on the path, right?
Yeah.
Ourselves. And
Relationship.
that relationship is so important. I never quite like, yeah, it always blows me away, right? Each time I'm like, oh, right, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never really thought of myself as like a relationship sort of guy. So
Yeah.
yeah, that relationship's really, really, really important. So I thoroughly enjoyed that and totally reset at all kind like my whole like it hasn't gone away, right? Like, like I feel really different. As a result, and my meditation practice, which was Part of it, you know, like it was when it was happening, it was feeling blah. I wasn't bringing, you know, it wasn't joyful effort. It was just effort, you know. And that has all shifted. It's really my sort of my commitment to it, and my practice has just yeah, it's stabilized and feels amazing. So like, I'm stoked about that. And then I got to come. What was also really neat is that normally I can't come on Sundays when Lama's teaching. My schedule with my kids and stuff, it alternates, and it happens to be, so I can usually come when a student is giving a talk, but I usually can't come when Lama's talking. So yeah. I usually catch his talks on YouTube, which I'm super duper grateful for. So if anybody, you know, you hear us talking about our teacher, Lama Yeshe Jimpa, I highly recommend the Lion's Roar Dharma Center YouTube channel.
Yes.
Because you can listen to his talks there. I'm so grateful for them. But I got to come on Sunday.
Nice.
And Lama was teaching, and it was just like fantastic, because it's the, you know, it's receiving the teachings directly from him, and also being with the Sangha on those days, like it tends to fill out a little bit more. And then we have like a potluck lunch afterward. And that was really enjoyable, seeing everybody hanging out together, and yeah, just beautiful. So yeah, I'm super, super excited. And like,
yeah,
there's some fresh air in here, so to speak.
Yeah, in the sails. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I love that. So it sounds like you were like, you had a lot of resistance, what, you know, just like a lot of drag, right?
Yeah.
just stuff pulling on you. And it is weird when it's like, and I don't know if this was the case for you, but when it's not, you can't trace it to a particular like event, or like, you know, even sometimes we have like triggers, right, that we can identify.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's just a mood. And what the Dharma teaches us too is that even if we do identify like a particular trigger, that's not really it either. Like,
no.
It's not.
There is no one. There's no one-to-one relationship here, right? It's all right. Interdependent.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, one thing that did change that I got to just give a little shout out to my...
It kind of cut out a little bit.
I need to give a shout out to my girlfriend Megan, because part of the reason why my practice was suffering was that I was having a hard time finding like creating space for like actual sitting. So I'd always have to be sort of in a different place, and something about it didn't feel right.
Yeah.
And she recognized this, right? And so she created a little space in the room and was like, there, that's yours. Like, you can hear some incense, here are the pictures that I remember you having on your wall, you know, like here's some space for you. And like, it made such a difference. I was like, wow, like that's like, it touched my heart, you know. And then I was like, oh good, I could do this. So now like, I'm like sitting in there meditating, I got my spot, like it's all good.
Nice. There is something to say about that, you know, having a consistent space. I'm looking at my altar right now, and I do think that there's some kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, like energy that we create there. This kind of consistent showing up to that same place and with our, you know, sacred objects and images and texts and whatnot. There's just this kind of like, even if I don't feel like quote unquote in the mood to meditate, there's a way that that draws me in. And you know, Lama talks about how important ritual is. And that, you know, it's just this way to turn our mind, towards what is useful, and to really, kind of drop in. So yeah, I think that's so wonderful that you've found, and she's helped you find a space, because that it'll help with the consistency and that sacredness.
Totally. I'm so grateful. And then not only that, Jack, but because of the way that this is set up, it's right next to the bed, right? And I, as a result, I'm able to put into practice some meditation instructions that Lama had given related to early morning meditation. And that, you know, in like basically that sort of that reverie state, you know, that initial pre-meditation stuff, right? And so I've been practicing that, and I'm like, wow, this is like, I haven't done this before.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, it works, right?
Oh, it's so cool. Well, one of the things that
It really works.
he talks about basically just sitting on, you know, sitting up in bed and basically just sit, like right when you wake up, just sit. Like you're not meditating or anything. You're just sitting there, right? And just like, and he said one of the things that you'll notice is that if you do this, that sometimes like your dreams don't disappear right away. You know, like you get to kind of hang out with them for a little bit and investigate them a little bit further. And that's been really great because when I have to get up and go somewhere else real quick, right? That any dreams that were happening, they evaporate. They're gone by the time I get to wherever I'm gonna be sitting and mess around with stuff. But in this case, what I've noticed is like, yeah, actually I can sit there and I can sort of like be with my dreams a little bit and see what was going on there before they're gone.
Interesting. I you know, I haven't done much kind of like dream analysis, but I do imagine that there, especially with like our meditation practice and we're, you know, moving along the path, that there's ways that our consciousness is gonna be doing some stuff when we're asleep. And then I know that there's also like the sleep yoga, where, you know, practitioners who like have been trained in how to do that, that you can actually use your time in sleep as meditation, which is just mind blowing. You know, that there are people in the world who really are just so committed to practice that they're also willing to use their sleep time, which, you know, like for me, I'm just like, I want, like, I do have such an attachment to like sleep and a little bit of laziness and being in bed and cuddling up. Like, I don't see that as a meditation space, but I really I'm interested in that, and with maybe, yeah, that's an eventual practice I can learn, you know, eventually.
We'll grow in all of these practices, no doubt, along the way. But I'm so happy. Like I'm like I you know when the going gets a little tough, right? Sometimes it's just like it can be disheartening. And then of course our delusional mind is like, it's always gonna be like this, and you
It's
know,
like
like
this
I'm
is the real state,
That's
actually.
right. All that nonsense. It's never gonna change. I'm hopeless. I should just give up. I'm never gonna make it. Everybody else is better at this than me. And
Oh gosh, all the things.
all of that. Right. It's funny. So we get to catch ourselves being a little delusional from time to time.
Well, and how great that, you know, you got to meet with Lama, which I know for myself, when I've also been in states of kind of just like just really sticky, kind of sometimes despair, but just kind of like just dull and like not with it, not present with what I'm doing. Lama just has this way of like sharpening my mind, you know, just kind of directly in the moment. And yeah, it's just really wonderful because I same as you, leave those meetings feeling like I remember what I'm doing, right?
That's right. I love the
No.
way you put that, Jack. I leave feeling like I remember what I'm doing. That was beautiful. That was very well put. That was perfect.
Because it's, you know, we can easily get off course, you know.
And he's just like, okay, hey, nope, there you go.
Course correction,
You're
right?
good. You were just a little bit off over here. It's okay. Or maybe you weren't even off. You just misunderstood something.
Yeah, totally. And I actually had Darshan with Lama on Saturday, and he reminded me about how in my shamatha practice, you know, and I read this in books all the time, and I feel like I've heard it so many times, but it's so hard to get this, you know, through my thick skull about how shamatha is, you know, it's not about like coming down to like this relaxed state that I think meditation should be. And that actually he reminded me like, no, like that I am doing the training, right? You know, like I'm putting in the effort. And we were talking about that metaphor of having, you know, the hand over the face, you know, that we kind of, that's what our reality in samsara is like, is that we're, it's like, we just got our hand in front of our face. And if we could just, you know, just move it, then we'd see the nature of things. But so much of the gradual path of Buddhism, which most of us will be on, right, is not being able to remove our hands right away. It's this kind of slow, like, yeah. Oh, I'm starting to see stuff behind my hand that it's really interesting. And then, oh God, it's back, you know?
Yeah.
And so like, I was reminded that, okay, my hand is no longer like directly on my face. It's maybe it's like an inch off. And so that's good. That's like, that's really good. So to take stock of those gains, is really, really important. Cause we can get kind of, lost in feeling like this is the new normal. Like it's just a kind of like the dullness of normalcy, but looking back, it's like, actually, yeah, no, things have really changed dramatically. Keep doing it, you know, like keep doing the work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's working.
Yeah, right. This one being, I know.
Can I ask you something, though? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm just curious if you could, for our listeners, maybe, and me, if shamatha, which is sometimes called calm-abiding meditation, is not about being blissed out, peaceful, calm, if that's not what it's about, what is it about?
That's a good, excellent question. And hopefully I'll just, you know, I'll be able to answer from what I've read and learned from Lama. We're developing this ability to stay with what's there and to look into it and stay with it. So whatever's arising, whether it is a calm, blissful state or a kind of chaotic state, you know, can we stay aware? Can we practice pointing our focus? But it's also, yeah, it's not like, I used to think of shamatha as being this kind of like, I got to drill down and like really just focus, you know?
Yeah.
But apparently it's not that either. It is like looser. It's kind of like open attention and awareness. So that's kind of what I'm getting to know shamatha as, but it seems like as I work on it more, it kind of becomes more complicated in some ways.
Yeah.
And then in other ways, maybe a little bit simpler too. So, but yeah, it's not about attaining a blissful state. It's about, you know, can I be present? Can I be aware? Can I be aware of my excitement and my dullness, you know? And, you know, so there's practices where we use antidotes, right, to kind of come back to presence. And then there's other forms of shamatha where, like, antidotes aren't encouraged. Yeah. So, yeah, it's just really, really fascinating stuff.
Like all of the other practices, all the other training that we can do, it's an endless ocean, right? Like,
yeah,
we're never going to be able to explore all of the teachings and practices and train everything in a single lifetime. There's no way you could spend a whole lifetime just working on shamatha, right?
And that, I mean, that is why I need a teacher, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Because there are so many directions even within one one form of meditation that you can go. And so to have someone who can say, listen, just do this.
Yeah.
You know, right. Like do this, study this, and you know, sit. And here's how. And with your particular mind. Because otherwise, yeah, it feels totally daunting. And the real problem with shamatha too is that you know, the texts say that people can get really lost in attaining those very deep states of bliss and calm and meditation that they're kind of missing the other points of the Dharma.
Yeah.
So they're kind of just going after this blissful state, which is not, you know, that's not being a bodhisattva. Being able to be calm and present and aware certainly will aid you in your bodhisattva activities. And so we should be, you know, practicing and trying to do those things, but it to make that the path is like a misguided path.
Yeah, absolutely. That's as Lama oftentimes uses the sort of analogy of, you know, driving from your current spot to another spot, right? And you look at a map, you plan out your route and everything. He goes, you know, and then there's nothing wrong with, you know, taking an exit along the way and having a bite to eat or see some scene, right? Just like in our meditation, it's okay, it's fine, right? You have a blissful state, or you see all kinds of colors or whatever, and you have some happy moment. Great. That's fantastic, but that's not the destination. That's not what you're trying to do. It's just sort of like something that happens along the way, like filling up the gas and grabbing some snacks at the gas station.
Right. Yeah, that it is kind
of
like,
weird. It'd be kind of weird to be like, "Whoa, we're now. That's it. We're here." Right.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Like, wow, this gas station is amazing.
Right. I don't need to go anywhere else. I got nothing else to do. I'm just gonna hang out here.
And technically, that might end up being true. Like, you can probably sustain yourself living at a gas station, right? But no, you don't want to stay there.
No, not at all. All right, besides your darshan and whatnot, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Yeah. So this morning I kind of I made a commitment to wake up a little bit earlier this morning. I attended a teaching on a book that some of us are reading with Lama. And I was just kind of reminded, like, okay, if I really want to study at the level that I'm trying to, and with the schedule that I have, like, I really just do need to wake up earlier. And what was different for me this time compared to other times that I've had these thoughts around, like, oh, I gotta get on top of things, you know, like I gotta wake up earlier, is that it's, you know, it's pretty punitive. In the past, it's been kind of like, oh, you're not doing it right, and you need to do this better, and the kind of like should-haves, like I should be doing this. But what was different with this morning and last night as I was preparing for this was that I really just wanted to. Like, it's kind of, it's come to that, which I think had to be a gradual process for me of seeing, like, okay, yeah, this is actually just what's going to work for what I want to be doing. But I do think it took, you know, like I've been for the last couple months doing, you know, my prayers and shamatha practice in the morning, but not really having much time for reading. So that's kind of what I'm tacking on. And I'm really not, you know, adding that much more time, maybe 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But I think that is really like important. So, you know, I don't necessarily feel like I need all that much more quantity of study at this moment. It's just like, okay, I'm going to get in some quality time before I sit. That's so yeah, it went well this morning. I don't feel like more tired, you know, like I actually feel more energized in a way. So yeah, I like that. I'm going to try it again tomorrow. Yeah, things
good
are moving.
Good job, Jack.
Thank you. Yeah, and right now it doesn't necessarily feel like resistance, so I'm sure that resistance will show up.
Sure.
It always does, and then we work with it.
The good news about resistance is that there's always some juicy treasure on the other side of it.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, I agree. Like,
without fail, you meet resistance, it's hiding something good.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't play video games, but it's like finding a loot box or something.
Yeah, totally. Yes. I really like that you put it in those terms, because that is such a great way for us to turn our minds to the Dharma, like when maybe things go awry or we're just feeling crappy, like just reminding ourselves, this is such a potent moment.
I'm getting close.
Yeah. And so to just like almost be excited, you know, if we can see it that way, like, oh man, I'm learning so much right now. I think that's a really good.
It is. That's one of those things that our teacher helps with, right? Is like, hey, actually, what you're seeing as a negative, or what you're seeing as some type of, you know, an obstacle that you can't overcome, is actually a great gift. Look at this. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, which actually reminds me. So there's something kind of wild happening with a temple in Eastern Washington it's actually a monastery, Sarvasti Abbey. I don't know if you've heard, but actually one of their teachers, his name is Geshe Chodrak. He's gone missing in the last week. And they are in a forested area, and they believe that he got lost. And there's a whole kind of like search party and like just lots happening. So definitely keep him and the Abbey in your thoughts and prayers. But the thing that I've found so inspiring about this really difficult situation is that a couple of the teachers have given talks during this week and have talked about how to remain in Dharma and to practice with this situation. And I just was so blown away by their steadfastness and their discipline, you know, which we're going to talk about tonight. And just their real commitment to turning everything towards the Dharma. And so, yeah, it's just really amazing. Like, I felt this kind of well of gratitude and like just deep admiration for these practitioners, you know, and for the Dharma, really, because that's, you know, when we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, really what we're taking refuge in is the Dharma, because, you know, our teachers, the Buddha and the Sangha, they're sharing the Dharma with us. And so I just felt so deeply that they were like, everything that they've been putting out is Dharma. And yeah, I really, I wish for his safe return, and also just really admire the folks there.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that, Jack.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's been kind of on the back burner for the last few days. Yeah.
Well, hopefully he gets found soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Well, I think it might be some time for some mind training, isn't it?
Ooh, a little Lojong slogan coming right up.
Last week we were a little bit caught off guard by our slogan. So maybe they'll give us an easy one this time.
That was challenging for sure. I was flabbergasted.
The spirit in the computer is trying to to throw us off.
Keep us on our toes.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay. Number 38. Don't seek others' pain as a means to happiness. So let's see what Charlotte Kabgon says. Seeking happiness at someone else's expense is another common human trait, according to the Lojong commentaries. Absolutely. We all want happiness, but we tend to look for it in all the wrong places. And as a result, the pleasures and joys we experience can quickly degenerate into suffering and sorrow.
Ain't that the truth?
That is such, yeah. And I appreciate that what he says there about it can quickly, you know, the kind of pleasure that we get from, you know, taking joy in someone else's pain, how easily that just kind of degenerates. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like caustic, just pain, right? Like it doesn't feel good to wish, you know, negative things on someone or to take delight in their suffering. That goes away fast.
So So, you know, the one thing that came to my mind right when I saw this was that feeling of Schadenfreude, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm guilty of it on a
Oh, me
number of
too.
occasions, right? Where there is this sort of like, oh, yeah, they got what's coming to them, or
Yeah.
something like that. And I think it's those are, if we catch ourselves, it's a really good opportunity for mind training, right?
Totally. Yeah.
Because that's certainly not the direction that we want to be going. The people that cause the most grief in our lives and the lives of others are the ones who need our compassion more than anybody else, actually, right?
Yeah.
It's easy to feel compassionate and kind towards people who have sort of ordinary suffering, right? The kind that we can relate to pain and suffering, where we're like, oh, that poor person, and we have like pity or whatever. But the people who, you know, who we feel sort of deserve what's coming to them
Yeah.
or whatever, they're sometimes the hardest ones to feel, you know, compassion or extend kindness towards. But
Yeah.
they're the ones who really need it. And this is yeah, this is an important instruction.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and even if it's just to try and turn turn our mind in the moment, because we have such a great example of it right now in politics. You know, I think so many of us are probably watching the Donald Trump hearings and trial with a lot of that Schadenfreude, right? Where it's like, this jerk has been conning people for decades, and we just want to take him down, right? There's I'm never going to be in touch with Donald Trump, so I can't directly give him compassion. But if there's a way that I can change in my mind my approach, whether it's saying like, yeah, just like I hope that whatever comes out of this, he's actually able to learn something. And then immediately, what happens when I think that is there's this immediate pushback of like, oh, you think he's actually going to learn something from this? Like it's kind of. Like, and so that's really interesting to watch too, is like, yeah, can't it this battle that happens in my mind with stuff like that. It's
Yeah, that's I'm glad that you brought that up, but you remind me of something that our friend Marie Gillies had brought up or had mentioned one time, which was that she had wanted to do, she does our the Tonglin teaching around here, and she had brought up the fact that she had wanted a group called Tonglin for Trump,
Yeah.
but that Lama has suggested that maybe world peace would be a better one. So it's Tonglin for world peace, but I like the idea, right?
Do.
Like
I like that
I mean,
idea.
like actually, you know, it's not a bad idea to try practicing. You know, if that's a feeling, you know, if you're feeling particularly angry or whatever towards either Trump or Biden or some other figure, public figure, it's not a bad idea to practice a little Tonglin with them.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and also, maybe starting with people who are a little bit easier might help. But even then, the easiest people in my life, I get so freaking annoyed by them, right?
Yeah.
So yeah.
I like doing public figures, actually.
Me too.
I
Yeah, no, I like it too. Yeah.
yeah, I there I don't know, it's weird. They don't seem particularly difficult.
Well,
I
that's
feel
the
like people
interesting
closer to
part.
me are di more difficult.
Yeah, and we talked about
Yeah,
that
we did.
recently,
Yeah.
where it's like when something's closer to you, it's actually much harder, because those people are directly in our space all the time.
Exactly.
And even though people like Donald Trump do things that have an effect on us, they're also, they're far. They're
Right.
not in my direct space. But yeah. I know there's some of our Sangha members who are like, no, I am directly affected by Donald.
Oh, for sure,
I'm
for
thinking of
sure.
one person in particular who just makes me laugh.
Well, but that's the thing, is that actually some people are going to feel directly impacted, right, by certain people,
And
and they
it's true,
are, and
it,
so of
we
course
are.
they're going to feel more triggered by them, and it's going to be more difficult, for
Right,
sure.
for sure. Yeah, and
Yeah.
yeah. Rightfully, there are direct ways that all of us are being impacted, some of us more than others. So, yeah, I
Yeah.
get it.
Yeah.
And yeah. And Tong Lin. Sweet. All right. Well, thanks, Slow John slogan generator.
All right. Do you see the beautiful image of Vajravarahi?
Yeah, that's really, really nice. Wow, look at those eyes.
Yep. Beautiful. All right. So let me see if I can stop sharing here. Okay. There we go.
Awesome. Well, we are on to part two of the six paramitas, the six perfections. And the first one was generosity. And last week, I really, really felt inspired by our conversation. And I know that I think, and maybe you can help clarify this, but the six paramitas are kind of progressive, right? So it starts with generosity. And then do you know why discipline is next, ethical kind of conduct?
I don't know why it's next, but I do know that it's usually built in or in that particular order. Shanti Deva actually says that in the Bodhisattvas, how do you say the actual, is it Bodhisattva Avatara?
Bodhicharya
Avatara, there
Something
we go.
Like that.
Yeah, he says that the six paramitas progress in sequence, growing in importance, and that it's others' good that is the highest goal. So they each sort of lay the foundation for the next one. But the thing is, it goes both ways. Right, like it's true that it does appear as if they sort of are the foundation for the next one and the next one. But I mean, even in this particular case, we can see how ethical discipline can affect our generosity, right? Because like we were talking about, there's sort of wrong ways of giving, right? There's ways of selfish giving, for example. Mm-hmm. And so if we are disciplined, then we're not going to be doing that. So I think it goes both ways, but yeah, they do build on one another for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, and I was thinking about how when I think of discipline, the kind of definition that comes to me is like not being distracted from what I'm doing, like really being kind of on top of things, you know, getting the job done. You know, it's this kind of like very American type of discipline. When really, you know, as I was learning about this, it's the ethical conduct. It's the discipline is more about not doing harm. And of course, that does take this kind of, you know, my definition of discipline, which is this, you know, kind of being a little bit structured with ourselves, right?
Yeah.
Because to really put effort towards, you know, not doing harm, we have to, in some cases, restrain ourselves, don't we? So that was interesting for me to explore discipline as ethical conduct.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, when I think of discipline or self-discipline, I recoil. You know, and I think part of that is because of my Western philosophical religious upbringing. The discipline was always sort of imposed from outside. Right. Like somebody else, God or the church or the government or somebody was telling me what I needed to do, how I needed to do it. And that like there was like this prescription, right? Or proscription, like it's like this and you do that and you don't do that. And I hate that, right? Like that, like there's like that's what brings out the anarchist in me, right?
Yeah.
I do not want that. It doesn't work for me at all. Sort of rule-based behavior in general, I find abhorrent for that reason. But what I love about this notion of discipline that we're talking about is that it follows this natural progression. And it's organic. It doesn't come from outside. It's true. We learn things. We learn about ethical conduct, right? And there are, in fact, you know, like rules for monastics and vows that lay people can take, right? There are these sort of like rules or guidelines that do exist within the tradition, but it is always built upon, like, it comes from within and it follows naturally from our desire. In this case, you know, if we're following the Bodhisattva path, our desire to wake up to be of benefit to other beings, right? It all follows from that. And so then, you know, like all of the training that we do and all of the paramitas are all in line with that. Like, it's not something that's coming from outside of us. Yeah. So whatever we're doing, if we're living, if we're practicing this sort of ethical discipline, it's organic, it's natural, and is not imposed upon us from the outside. And like, that really struck me as being super important.
Absolutely. Yeah, that kind of that intrinsic motivation to become a what I like to say, what always kind of comes up for me is that I want to be a safe person for other people.
Yeah.
You know, safety doesn't mean that I'm going to, like, you know, okay anything that people do, right? But to really become to loosen my ego and my desires so that I'm no longer kind of dangerous. I really, you know, there's these ways that I've noticed over the last couple of years how kind of like obsessing over something, you know, whether it be like a new album that I'm listening to over and over and over again, or like thinking about, you know, like kind of getting wrapped up in like online shopping or something. There's this way that like this, yeah, just this kind of like shift in my attention towards something like that I want outside of myself that really, really changes how I act with other people. Because I'm like less attuned to people. I'm more up here. I'm just like thinking. Oh, I want that thing. I want to hear that song. And so I think there's a real shift in how people feel around us when we're going through all those motions of attachment or aversion, you know?
Yeah.
Really interesting to feel that change.
Yeah, it cuts us off. It cuts that connection, right? When we go, I've noticed that myself, right? Like when I go into that space of, let's just say attachment, like you were talking about, right? And I'm wanting something, like that's not here now usually, right? Like it presents itself in when I'm in relation with somebody else. If I'm up here thinking about something else, you know, I'm not connected. That connection is like it's severed somehow or reduced.
Yeah. And you know, I think what has been so helpful for me have been the precepts and kind of helping me put some guardrails on some of that behavior, you know, that, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't cover everything that I can get kind of sidetracked on, but some pretty big ones, right?
Yeah. It, you know, what I love about them too, is that the precepts are, they can really, you know, you can take them sort of at a superficial level, you know, or you can kind of go deeper and you can see how, you know, that it can affect, it can have a more nuanced understanding of them, right? And it can affect behavior beyond just the simple, right? Like I'm not going out and murdering people, right? I never have, right? But the very notion, you know, that I've taken a vow to not kill, if I sit with that, it can translate into other facets of life.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and the one that I know we've talked about that we were kind of questioning, like, should I or can I even, you know, take refuge and take these precepts is the fifth precept, right, about intoxication. And just like you were saying, you know, I'm sober now. Like, I don't use any kind of substance. I mean, I use caffeine, right? That's what I use.
And sugar.
but yeah, there's this way that, like, intoxicants have become not just things that I consume, but also things that I'm listening to, or like, am I becoming intoxicated by the news, right? Like, that's something I have to really be aware of. And I was listening to a video before this, and a teacher was describing how that sometimes our minds can get intoxicated, that by a, like a rumor, like maybe we hear a rumor about ourselves, right? And so then that's all that, like our mind has just shifted towards that. And so that's kind of like an intoxicant in itself, because it's totally changed our consciousness and shifted it away from anything positive, right?
Right. We've gone chasing that stick, right? Like we're off, like, you know, not here, right? We're going somewhere else chasing that intoxicant.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So it's kind of like, it's all encompassing, which can feel kind of daunting, but yeah, I think that's part of our practice of mindfulness is like, okay, I'm just starting to notice, like, it's, you know, intoxication can mean a lot of different things. And so where do I need to be a little bit kind of guarding my sense doors, which is a practice of just kind of being aware of like the different kind of sense pleasures that I can take in, and how is that affecting me? How am I getting caught up in that? So yeah, I think it's like, not that I have to kind of go to a cave and like drop it all, right? But that I just need to become kind of more conscious of how those things are affecting me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's important. I think one of the things that I like about the paramita of discipline is this notion that it's not all so like black and white. Like it really ultimately within our tradition, what it comes down to is your motivation and your intention, like what it is that, you know, like, what are you actually trying to achieve here? And with that in mind, you know, like it's easy, for example, to get intoxicated, for example, by food, right?
Yes.
But there's a way of eating. There's a way of relating to food with great intentionality, right? And with like, and to use it as a training tool to develop mindfulness, right? And compassion and understanding about interconnectedness and emptiness, right? All of this, right? Yeah. There's a way of doing that. And so, you know, like we want to, you know, like I think that part of what you were talking about with the sense doors is that there's this vigilance on the one hand, right? To watch like, well, what am I thinking about? What is giving rise to actions of my speech or behavior of my body, right? What really is going on here, and what's my motivation behind it? And when we start to look at our intention, we start to look at our motivation, it affects our behavior, because if we have as our guide the desire to not harm and to be helpful, if that's our primary motivation, we have this warm, compassionate heart, right? And we have this one sort of singular objective, right? Then we can really laser in, right? And we can use all of our activities, regardless of what they are and how distracting they might be, to practice dharma.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think I'm that feels like a really high, well, not for everything, but I was going to say it feels like a high level practice for me, at least for the activities that are still like really kind of irritating or exciting to me, you know, like where I have to be a little bit conscious, you know, so that I'm not swept away. Like sometimes it's interesting, music can be a really strong, powerful current for me. Like it can actually change my mood and affect how I feel sometimes for days, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I am curious, that has changed, you know, I've noticed that has changed, but there's certain things that I think all of us are maybe a little bit more affected by that we need to be conscious of, for sure.
Of course.
Yeah. I really like, you know, so there's kind of different approaches, right? For when we notice that something is, kind of just affecting us a lot, you know, there's the approach of just straight up avoiding it, right? Which is, you know, that's totally valid. And then there's this kind of practice like you were talking about, like, how can I turn my mind to the Dharma within this very experience?
Yeah.
And I think always like the practice of equanimity can be this kind of dose of just like dropping into, okay, this is the reality of the situation, is that this is not actually that exciting. It's just an experience, you know, and it's changing, it's shifting. So like to notice when I'm feeling that strong attachment, like when I'm listening to a song or something, and if I can catch like, oh, there's this physical thing happening. Okay. It kind of corresponds with that melody. Let me just kind of watch that, you know, and recognize like, okay, that passes, you know, and maybe instead of going back to that song five more times, what I can do is just recognize like, yeah, that was nice. And now I'm going to do this other thing, you know?
Yeah. That's funny. You know, you made me think of something that Lama said not too long ago, related to this, that was essentially about turning these, I don't know what they are, attachments or these certain experiences into sort of protector practice, which I found really fascinating, actually. He mentioned, he said, like, you know, I don't drink, you know, it's been a long time since I've had a drink. He goes, but sometimes, you know, like I'll, at the end of a long day or whatever, I'll go home and, you know, and I'll feel like, you know, I'm not going to drink, but if I was going to drink, today would be the day, right?
Totally, yeah.
And then he said, you know, and that can help to turn our mind, that we can actually look at that desire or that craving or whatever is going on right there. And we can let it sort of clue us into like what's happening actually with ourselves, like a dashboard light, right? Like, and help us be like, oh, well, I'm not going to do that, but I do know what will help me, right? I'm going to, you know, go to sleep, or I'm going to meditate now, or I'm going to read, or I'm going to call up a Sangha friend or something to that end.
Yeah. We're becoming pretty smart with our those things that activate us.
Slowly. It's a gradual path, Jack, as you said. I don't claim any smartness around it, but maybe gradually.
Yeah. And I think it starts with that kind of familiarity, and if we can also bring a little bit of humor, like, oh, there you go again.
Yeah. Wow. Look at you.
Oh, I'm starting to get to know you. Okay.
Isn't that precious? There you are again.
I do think that is part of a disciplined practice when it comes to like reminding ourselves of our path and where we want to be, is like, okay, I'm not going to whip myself into shape anymore. You know, like that's, it just doesn't really work. So, you know, when I notice, okay, I'm not exactly with the kind of ethical guidelines that I'd like, or I'm behaving in a way that I find annoying or harmful or something, you know, it doesn't help to be mean to myself. I feel like I have to say that over and over and over again.
Right. Yeah. If that worked, you know, like, first of all, I'm not capable of whipping myself very well.
Right.
You know, but if I could learn to do that, it still doesn't appear to work. I haven't seen any signs of it working anywhere else. And, you know, like we've talked about, like there's been times in the past, you know, where we're like, you know, really trying to whip ourselves. And then we're like, come on, somebody, Lama, whip me. And it's like, no, that's not what we're doing here. Right. That's not it at all. We want to see clearly what's happening, and we, you know, we want to understand the source of our suffering and how we're causing suffering for others, and we want to feel properly motivated to end that suffering, and we want to then learn how to do that, right? That's what we're on about, right? that's what all this discipline talk is about, right? Is ultimately about, you know, liberation from suffering, our own and that of others,
right. Yeah, we don't want to shoot the second arrow, right? We don't need that second arrow. Like, yes, we recognize we are flawed, sentient beings. We're making harmful mistakes all the time. But yeah, we don't need to shoot that second arrow of like self-hatred and just denigration that is
exactly
so common. Yeah. Mm-mm. Well, Daniel, what comes next? Do you know?
Patience.
Patience. Great. So we're going to.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure patience is next.
Yeah, great.
Which is going to be interesting because I suspect, actually, I have not gone into it at all, but I suspect it's a little bit like discipline in that it probably doesn't mean exactly what I sort of initially think.
Yeah.
Right? It might encompass a little bit of like being patient with, you know, jerk drivers or something. It might involve some of that, but I have a feeling that the topic of patience is going to extend well beyond those sort of normal concepts.
I agree. Yeah, there's always little nuggets, surprising nuggets to find in these trainings.
And I feel like, you know, I do feel like we're really just barely skimming the surface. I gotta tell you, Jack, I came across something really wonderful. Mm-hmm. It is this amazing resource. It's a discussion or a writing, a teaching, if you will, from the Dalai Lama on the six perfections, the six paramitas. And you can find it on studybuddhism.com. I found it really quite eye-opening and interesting. The style is very easy to understand. The logic is all sort of like, it's perfect, right? It all like lines up, this, then that, then that, then this, and it kind of builds on itself. And it's deep. I mean, it said the intro to the topic actually says that he is briefly talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. But then you read it and it goes pretty deep actually. And so it just, you know, like it's another one of those, you know, like the paramitas are one of those endless topics for sure. Oh, yeah. But I do want to recommend it. It's an amazing writing.
Awesome. So remind us, what was the, was it an article or a book?
Yeah, it's an article called The Dalai Lama on the Six Perfections, and it's on studybuddhism.com.
Great. Thank you. Yes, there's some great stuff on studybuddhism.com. I also read an article by Alexander Berzin about the 10 destructive actions, like, you know, the things to avoid. And that was really excellent. So yeah, good resource there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everybody. It's always a pleasure. And just a reminder, if you're able, please make a donation to Lion's Roar. We've got a donation tab on the website. You know, even just a few bucks, if you're a regular listener, we would super appreciate it. Yeah. So super looking forward to next week, Daniel.
Me too. I will patiently be waiting for our discussion next week. Thank you so much, Jack. I really appreciate this.
Thanks, Daniel. Appreciate you
too. Bye, everybody.
Bye.